to give us a guest lecture for our course. Sean has been a big contributor to developing the material we've been using all throughout this course and the code and the tutorial. And we've also been talking about some of his research results, and he's going to tell us a little bit more about that today too. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the invitation and for everything, for the kind introduction. So this is my first talk in 2 years, like in person, so it's exciting. And also using a physical thing is always fun. So I'm going to tell you about quantum many body systems through the lens of autoregressive models. This is basically summarizing a bunch of results we have using this type of techniques, autoregressive models, for some problems in quantum many-body physics and quantum information. All right, and mostly in collaboration with Mohammed, Lauren, and many more people. So it's been fun working on these problems. So I guess you already know this, but ML and quantum science research are experiencing a surge, in research at the intersection between these two topics, not just condensed matter, but quantum information, statistical physics, atomic and molecular and optical physics, and there's a lot of excitement, and these communities are exploring research on these two topics, and it seems fruitful and fun. This interest is shaped in part because of the commonalities in the structure of the problems that these disciplines address. Okay, so there are very strong similarities between these disciplines and the topics and so on. And what I'll try to explore is those ideas, those intersections, and whether this is a good idea or not. And so first, what are these commonalities? The first one and the easiest to see is the dimensionality, okay? So in quantum physics, everything you can possibly know about a quantum state is specified through its wave function, okay? That's psi. It's a vector which, for a spin 1/2 particle, is a vector with 2^n components. If you have n spins, 1/2 particles, it's a complex vector. And this dimensionality is, growing so fast, so exponentially, that even today's best supercomputers can solve Schrödinger's equation roughly exactly for a system of up to around 45 spins, okay? And that already for 45 spins, that number is very big, and it's because of memory and time limitations, okay? But in real life, or in physics, we want n to be as large as possible, especially in condensed matter physics, where we're interested in understanding the behavior of many particle systems, where n can be as large as like the Avogadro number, okay? So there's no hope, but the commonality or the machine learning side, and here I have an example in language models. So these models, these probabilistic models that you see, they are used for translation when you use Google Translate and voice assistants and so on. So these models live in spaces that are very large too, okay? And in here I have an example from a paper in 2017. The paper is called Attention is All You Need, a very interesting paper where they introduce an architecture called Transformer. And the count that you do is similar, right? Like, so you have this two comes from the fact that spins can be up or down, and n, that you have n of them, and so it's 2^n. So in language models, is the vocabulary size, okay, to the maximum length of a sentence in a word-based model, okay? And so vocabulary size, if you want to read a paper, like a newspaper, like your average newspaper is about 8,000 words in English for a BBC, okay, on average. And the maximum length, you can say a paragraph is about 100 words, if I remember correctly. So that gives you this number, which is much, much larger than this, right? And but I guess the commonality here is we want these spaces to be very large, and they are very large. And that's the first commonality, okay? So both machine learning research and practice and many-body physics deal with equally high-dimensional systems, right? But yet we are able to make progress. So that's what we want to exploit here. And the idea is that even though those spaces are so high-dimensional, most paragraphs, for instance, in text and so on, would be noise if we exploited all like the space limit, like the dimensionality in its full capacity, right? Meaning that these probability distributions over language have a lot of structure. And the sentences that our brain understands live actually in a lower dimensional subspace, okay? Not in this full, and probabilities live on a simplex, which I express here as a triangle. And the probability distributions realized in natural language and so on live in a lower dimensional subspace, okay, of this full probability distribution. And the same is true for physical states, right? So physical states realized in nature live in a lower dimensional subspace of the full Hilbert space, okay? So around here you have typical average states. And those are not, in general, realized in nature. You have a set of physical states that that are realized. And then, so that's another similarity, right? That, and the similarity is brought by the common or by the structure of the problems that we looked at, okay? Like, I don't know, if we're talking about physical systems, like ground states of Hamiltonians, these Hamiltonians are local, they're not completely random and all to all and so on. So it's just strings. The dimensionality of the subspace where the states live, okay? All right, so that's the other commonality. And then this one is also interesting. So the, and perhaps the most important is this common structure. So we know that probability distributions in machine learning have a structure, and we know the states that we're interested in many-body physics have some structure. What's not trivial, in my opinion, is the structures are common. So there's some similarities between the probability distributions that we use to describe language and the probability distributions that we use to describe physical systems or many-body systems. Okay, and I'll give you one example just to be more concrete. I'll give you critical correlations and symmetry. They have very similar structure. So for instance, natural language, natural images, music, they all exhibit power law decaying correlations that are identical to a classical or quantum system at the critical point, okay? And this is not just words. So here's one example with natural images. So someone in 2013 or around that age, around that year, they went ahead and took pictures in a forest in New Jersey, a bunch of them, okay? And then they took little squares of that picture, of those many, many pictures, and they fitted probability distributions to them, okay? And then they rescaled them. So so those distributions that they got, they call them temperature T equals one, okay? And then they redefined those distributions and assigned a temperature. And they computed the specific heat of this emerging distributions of natural images. And this is what they found, that the specific heat is, it has this shape as you make the sizes of this little rectangle, 2x2, 3x3, 4x4. And what they saw was this behavior of the specific heat. And then if you compare that behavior with the specific heat of the Ising model, so this is what you get. For the 2x2 Ising model, 3x3, 4x4, and for the thermodynamic limit eventually.
Sorry, what exactly is the specific heat in the image case?
It's you take, I guess, as if it's related to the energy fluctuation, okay? Average energy squared. So that is the specific heat. So how do they define it? It's through defining a probability distribution over the images. Okay. And then the Hamiltonian would be minus the log of whatever they get. Okay.
And the image, so you're not looking at the pixels of one image, but really probability over the image.
Exactly. So they fit probability distributions to those data sets that they got out of the of this data set of images. Okay. That's the idea. And the interesting thing is those images sit near or behave as if they came from a critical system at some temperature, at some finite temperature T. Okay. And so that's, I think, very suggestive that there are many similar correlations or commonalities between the physical systems that we're interested in and natural images, natural language, and so on and so forth. Apart from the critical correlations, there's some translational, rotational, reflection, and other symmetries that simultaneously enrich our understanding of quantum physics and classical statistical mechanics, but also that if we account for them when we're using them as a learning algorithm, they improve the sample complexity of the algorithm. Okay, so those are like the commonalities that I wanted to discuss. And now I'll show you examples of research that we have done. If you have questions, maybe now is a good time to address them. But if not, then I can go ahead.
So the temperature of the image that you define is based on some the color pattern. How do we decide the temperature of an image?
Yeah, so you first fit probability distribution, and you define this as that temperature T equals 1, and then you basically rescale this probability distribution, and that's how you get those. I mean, you basically arbitrarily impose a temperature on one unique distribution that you got, and then compute these fluctuations according to this energy. So this is what they would call energy function, the log of the probability distribution. And it's because when you have the Boltzmann distribution, you have energy divided by T divided by the normalization. If you take the log, that's minus the energy, right? And that's why this is like an energy. So let's say energy, quote unquote. Okay. All right. So we said autoregressive models. So what are autoregressive models? They're probabilistic models, and the term autoregressive originates from the time series literature, where observing like previous observations or previous time steps are used to predict the value at the current time step. Okay, that's where it comes from. But for our purposes, you basically consider a probability distribution P of sigma, where sigma is a collection of variables, sigma 1 all the way through sigma n. You can always write this probability distribution in this form. This is called the chain rule of probability. And it's basically probability of sigma 1 times of probability of sigma 2 condition on sigma 1. Probability of sigma 3 condition on sigma 1 and sigma 2 and so on and so forth. So you can write any probability distribution in this form. However, if you want to specify any p in this form, it requires exponential resources. You would have to store all these conditionals for all possible values of sigma I. And so that would be very expensive. You would have to store these gigantic tables. And so that's not possible. And so people alleviate this exponential issue by parameterizing the conditional. So this is the conditional you want. And basically, you just create a function with parameters theta that specify specifies the conditional, okay? And the good news about, or the advantages of using this representation is that these distributions can be sampled exactly, very easily. The computing the probability of one configuration, sigma, bold sigma, is effective, is efficient if the representation is efficient. They can be defined in any spatial dimension. They are easy to manipulate. You can encode mean field theories. And in addition, you can impose symmetries and other useful physical properties. All right. So these properties remain true, all those, if you define wave functions or quantum states based on that autoregressive property. And we'll exploit that too. Oops. So a canonical example is the one you've already seen, the Mohammed's lecture, I believe, the recurrent neural network. Okay. And this, I'll just quickly remind you, so the key building block of a recurrent neural network is this function f, the recurrent cell. It has parameters w and b. And what's recurrent about it is this vector hn, which depends on hn minus 1. So n here is the time steps that I was discussing, or I in sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3, and so on and so forth. And so this is the, this gives the name, the recurrency of the cell, because of that dependency of hn on hn minus 1 and the configuration sigma n minus 1. And because of the way it is defined, it allows you to parameterize these conditionals, meaning that probability of sigma I would be dependent only on sigma I minus 1, sigma I minus 2, and so on and so forth, because of this, the way these dependencies are constructed. And this probability, this parameterization of the conditional, turns out it satisfies all these requirements, and it's given by in terms of HN through, for instance, the softmax activation function that you may have seen already last week or some time ago. The sampling is efficient. You can sample each conditional, and then, for instance, you initialize H0 and sigma 0, you compute P of sigma 1. Yes?
Yeah, I was just wondering about the comment at the bottom, RNN, or the paper. Is the main message of that paper essentially what you had on your slide before, saying that if we rebuild physics on this autoregressive idea, that we get the same results? Or
so this paper here, so this paper here is about the fact that a recurrent neural network can represent any function arbitrarily accurately if you allow the dimensionality of this vector grow arbitrarily big. It means that you can represent any probability distribution of this form with a recurrent neural network. So it's not exactly related to this. Because even if you don't have an infinitely expressive RNN, you can still encode symmetries, you can still sample efficiently, you can compute probabilities and so on, and you can still impose physical properties, even without having a very expressive model. Okay. All right, so that's the example, that recurrent neural network. But there are more, and this list is long. So there are so-called transformers, which you may have seen even the recent weeks in the news. This DALI model is based on transformers. There's other neural autoregressive density estimators and more. So there's a lot of models with these properties. So let me give you a couple of examples of research. So the first one is a data-driven learning of quantum states, or approximate quantum state tomography, where the idea is to estimate quantum states out of measurements. Okay, so traditionally, quantum state tomography is the process of reconstructing the quantum state from measurements. So you produce a quantum state, you measure it, and then you want to infer what the quantum state is out of this collection of measurements that you have. Okay, it's supposed to be the gold standard for verification and benchmarking of quantum devices and quantum states. And it's useful for characterizing, say, optical signals, detecting errors in state preparation and state produced by quantum computers, making sure everything works reliably and so on. However, traditional quantum state tomography requires exponential resources, okay? And both in terms of computational time and memory, okay? So, and one technique that is very popular and very powerful is maximum likelihood estimation. It requires an explicit physical representation of the density matrix. And as I was stating before, representing quantum states exactly, it's computationally expensive. Like this 2 to the n growth for the representation of the quantum state. And so basically the representation scales poorly. On top of the representation, so you have to represent this density matrix or quantum state rho exactly, you have to compute this likelihood function, which is the likelihood that you see some of this measurement, and that depends on the density matrix. And this manipulation is exponentially time consuming. And so it has the issue of exponential scaling in the parameterization and in the manipulation in time, okay? So that's a little bit of a challenge there. So we need to go beyond that standard because quantum devices are growing at a very fast pace, and there's a lot of progress in controlling large quantum systems. There's also availability of measurements on those systems that are performed with great accuracy. And so the bottleneck becomes estimation of states that has this poor scaling or curse of dimensionality of the traditional techniques. And so we came up with a bunch of ideas on how to approach this problem. And these are just examples of experiments for you to see that the systems are really growing fast. So this is recent from Harvard, so 256 atom programmable quantum simulator. That's too big, impossible to do quantum tomography. This is 219. This is 1,800. That was a paper where I was involved. This, I don't remember how many, but I guess the point is these devices are growing very fast, okay? And ideally, we'd like to have some sort of benchmarking of the states that they're trying to produce. And so so we did that, right? Like exactly. So first, how do we collect this data that we use to reconstruct the state? So data set is going to look something like that, a bunch of ones and zeros that are the outcomes of measurement on experimental data, ideally. So how do you do that? You prepare an unknown quantum state in your lab or in your quantum computer. You apply a measurement that hopefully props enough information about the quantum state. And you repeat. You have to do this many, many times because every time you prepare a state and you measure it, typically you collapse the wave function and you don't have the state anymore, but it changes dramatically. Then you take the data and you construct an approximate reconstruction of the state, okay, based on that data or consistent with that with those data that you collected. Okay, that's the data collection briefly. And then, okay, so how do you do this? So you have some measurements, and these measurements are described by positive operator valued measures, or POVMs. You may have seen this in quantum information courses. And there's a connection between the experiment, which is described by a measurement, your quantum state rho, that's also your experiment, and the outcomes of the measurements, or the statistics of the outcome of the measurement. So there's Born rule, which connects quantum theory, the state, and the description of the experiment of the measurements M with the statistics that you see in the experiment. Okay, so M are the measurement operators. And in general, you can describe any measurement with a P of M. Okay, but there's a particular or special class of measurements that are called informationally complete. And what that means is that the measurement statistics, this probability distribution P, contains all the information about the quantum state. Okay, if that's the case, then the relation between rho and P can be inverted. Okay, so here we have Born rule, and you go from a state that is a complicated object and so on, it's a high dimensional, to a probability distribution. Okay, so if you probe enough information about the quantum state, P will contain all that information. Okay, so it's, if you want a cartoon for like what information completeness means, is you have a state, and the state is a, say, high dimensional object. You can think of it as a 3D, object. And for you to have a reconstruction in 3D, you have to observe the quantum state from different directions. Okay, for you to have a kind of like a reasonable reconstruction of what the object looks like from, say, at least three directions or six directions, right? And information incompleteness or measurements that are information incomplete are like that, in that you have to probe the state from different directions in this high dimensional space. And if you can do that, then that means this relation rho and P can be inverted, meaning that we can write rho in terms of P, as opposed to what Born rule gives us, okay? The other aspect is that if you have information incompleteness, then M, the set of operators, becomes a basis for operators, okay, in whatever Hilbert space you're dealing with. Okay, so if that's the case, yes?
Does the informational completeness come from the set of measurements you take or the number of measurements?
Yes, so it comes from the number of measurement operators that you have, okay. Not the number of experiments you run.
Mm-hmm. But then the state itself is probabilistic, so you have to do that set of measurements multiple times on the state that's re-prepared.
Yes. Correct. Okay, so if that's the case, if we have access to such information, a complete set of measurements, then this relation can be inverted, and it looks like this. So you have the probability distribution on the right, and on the left you have the quantum state, and through the measurements, right? Like, so these are the operators that form a basis. So you can write basically the density matrix in that basis, and some coefficients here, and this T, so this is T inverse, but T is defined as the trace of MA and MA prime. Okay, it's not very important. It's a linear inversion problem because Born rule is linear. So that's the important thing. So so how do we learn and parameterize the state in this language? So what we did and we came up with a few years ago was, okay, instead of parameterizing rho directly in terms of an exponentially huge matrix, we can create a model for P, okay? And a model for P that we use is an autoregressive model, a recurrent neural network in particular, okay? And then why? Because it has these nice properties. You can sample them, you can have this tractable density, and you can use maximum likelihood estimation to train it. On what? On outcomes of the experiment. Because that probability distribution would represent the outcomes of the experiment, right? So that's what we did. We created this density matrix model, rho model, where we replaced the exact probability distribution with a probabilistic model given by the RNN. And the rest we leave untouched. So does it work? So this is a couple of examples. So this is learning the ground states of a local Hamiltonian from data, okay? And so this is all numerics so far. And then I'll show you one experimental plot. So it's basically green is the reconstruction from the RNN model on a ground state of the transfield IC model on 50 spins, for which you cannot do tomography. Too big. And the model that we use is a recurrent neural network, GRU, with three layers and so on. It doesn't matter, just to show you that the reconstructions in green match the exact state out of which the data came from. So this is numerical simulations where we are able to solve this Hamiltonian using density matrix renormalization group and collect this synthetic data. So we imagine producing this experiment, but instead of running the experiment, we just simulate having this data set in our computer. So that was good. Then we went to a little bit of a more complicated state, which is the ground state of the Heisenberg model in 2D on a triangular lattice. And we ran the experiment and we created this correlation functions of the synthetic state versus the reconstructed state, and they all worked. Okay. And so that was exciting, and we published it and so on. And that's the example. But then later we came up with an experimental demonstration of this. So we went ahead and constructed a state called the GHZ state on 3 qubits on an IBM machine. So they give you access to this quantum computers that you can play with. And so we collected a lot of data of that POVM M, and we reconstructed the density matrix in here with this in this case, we use a different architecture, so-called transformer, which is one more autoregressive model that I won't have time to go into the details. And I want to highlight Peter Cha, who was a PSI student like all of you. Okay, so he developed this and made it work, and it was again a very interesting demonstration of our technique. Now I'm going to introduce neural network wave functions and two more examples, and one is going to be quick. The idea is again to represent quantum state with neural networks, and what does that even mean? So we represent quantum states as 2 to the n dimensional vector for spin 1/2 or for qubits. And it's just a huge vector with 2 to the n components. So when we say we represent the wave function as a neural network, what we do is we create this parameterization psi of theta. And its input are these bit strings. Okay, and then we can just simply compute psi of theta and the bit string for as many bit strings as we want or as we need. Okay, and basically what we say is that that function psi theta is just a neural network where the inputs are those bit strings. Okay, and we call that, or people call that, a neural network quantum state. All right, so interestingly, so as we go from an exponential representation or an exponential amount of parameters to a neural network with as few parameters as you want, okay? And so that becomes efficient, but is it useful, right? That's the question. So this idea is not new. It turns out this was introduced already in the 1997 during the so-called AI winter. So it was this guy, Agares and Likas and Fotiadis, who came up with this idea of using artificial neural networks in quantum mechanics. And that's the idea. They were representing the ground state of a two-dimensional Schrodinger equation using feed-forward neural nets. Very simple problems, but the idea was there. So that was exciting. So these are results for a particular potential. It's called Hannon-Hiles potential. This Hamiltonian here. And so that idea has been there for a while, even during the one of the AI winters in the past. Then we came up with that idea of machine learning phases of matter. And in that paper, we also proved that the ground state of the toric code is a convolutional neural network that looks like this. So we recast this computation, or the ground state of this model, the mother of all topological states of matter, I would say, or the grandmother. And we took inspiration from the PEPS solution as a tensor network, and we were able to recast that ground state as a convolutional neural network. Okay, so that was my first like the first time I just tried to understand how to use these ideas in quantum physics. I guess the most influential paper is this one by Giuseppe Carleo and Matthias Troyer, where they took a particular form of feed-forward neural network called restricted Boltzmann machine to solve numerically, or to approximate numerically, ground states of many-body Hamiltonians. So this paper is from 2017. It's the most influential one in this kind of like area, an interesting read. But then Mohamed came up with this, that you can also use recurrent neural networks. And so we published that in 2020. I think you discussed this already a little bit, right? So I will go briefly through it. But also a PSI student, like all of you. RNN's wave function. So you basically take the RNN that I discussed before, and you create a coherent superposition. You add phases if you need, and then you use it for whatever you need, right? Like ground states and so on and so forth. So what we shown in those papers is that this wave functions produce very accurate results, even when you compare them with the MRG, especially in two dimensions. In one dimension, the MRG is very difficult to beat. But what we've shown is that this recurrent neural network is really good at describing this many-body systems. Okay, so that was exciting. We learned how to impose symmetries like spin inversion, mirror reflection, conservation of magnetization, even different Marshall signs, if I remember correctly. And I think it was very, very powerful idea, and it led to very interesting results. So that was quick because Mohamed already discussed it, but then I want to discuss this paper. It's called Neural Error Mitigation of Near-Term Quantum Simulations by Elizabeth Benewitz, Florian, and Bogdan, me, and Puya, Puya Ronak. Elizabeth was also a PSI, okay, like all of you. And that's the work she did when she was here. Now a PhD at Maryland. So, and that's the following idea. So suppose you have a quantum simulator or a quantum device that prepares some quantum state psi zero, okay? And suppose this device is not perfect. So it produces quantum states that are close to what you want, but not quite. And suppose that this quantum simulator starting to produce ground states of many-body Hamiltonian, okay? And so you go ahead, you go ahead and you produce the state you can with the device, and then you take a bunch of projective measurements, similar to the ones I was discussing before, from POVM that you can measure in the device. And there's all sort of problem with that preparation. And okay, so we get that state, and it's the best we can do with the quantum devices. Quantum devices right now are noisy and are imperfect. They come with all sorts of noise and imperfection, okay? So what Elizabeth proposed was, okay, let's do first a reconstruction of that state that you have produced using a neural network, okay? So similar to the RNN and so on, it was an autoregressive model. She in particular, I think she used the transformer architecture. Okay, and then, so you have your reconstruction, it uses some parameters and some like parameterization using this transformer. and you fit it the best way you can to the data set that you collected, to the training data. And so basically what you're doing is you're taking those measurements and estimating the state the device produced. Okay. And then that's imperfect and noisy and so on. So it may be far away from the ground state. All right. And then what she did was, okay, I'm going to take that initial wave function that is already close to what I want, and I'm going to use a variational Monte Carlo algorithm to try to get to the, or get closer to the ground state of the Hamiltonian that I'm trying to, that I was trying to simulate to start with. And then you take that wave function, you use VMC, variational Monte Carlo, which I think was discussed here too. And we call that a post-processing or a correction, because we were trying to solve that same problem on the quantum computer to start with. It's just that we can't because of noise and imperfections. And so we do the rest of the noise correction on a classical computer so that at the end we get a better approximation to the ground state. Okay. So does it work, right? Like, so I guess, as I said, so this is your measurement data. Then you have this transformer and this variation Monte Carlo technique that tries to improve this representation of the wave function. And we call that neural error mitigation. All right. So these are the results. So interestingly, so here we have experimental results from IBM machines as well. So this is for a lithium molecule. So the exact is black. So these are energies as a function of, I think, bond length in the molecule. And so here we have VQE, variational quantum eigensolver. So it's an algorithm that tries to approximate the ground state on a quantum computer. And it's kind of like imperfect and noisy. So the solutions are far away, quote unquote, from the true ground state, which is in black. Okay. And then we do a reconstruction, okay, using this neural network tomography. So those are in green, so it's still far away from the true solution because you're reconstructing the wrong quote-unquote state. But then we apply this variational Monte Carlo step at the end, the neural error mitigation, and then you get red. And you see that it's just significantly closer to the true ground state. Okay, so that was great. So that picture is not very clear, but here you will see the difference in energy between the true ground state and the error mitigated results. And we see that those differences are tiny, 10 to the minus 4 roughly. And so meaning that the method works well. And these are the reconstruction and the VQE results. So we have a significant improvement in the accuracy by several orders of magnitude in the energy. So we were happy about it. And this is the infidelity. So we see also an improvement in the fidelity of the calculation. So we were pretty happy. And this is, again, experimental. We also did numerical simulations with a noisy simulation. So basically, classical simulation on your laptop, trying to mimic the noise in these devices, just to verify that everything was working well and so on. And it's, I mean, again, we see the same as we see in the experiment, that as we apply this mitigation, the accuracy in the energy improves by several orders of magnitude, as well as the fidelity. So that was great news. So that's hydrogen and lithium, which is the same as we did experimentally.
Could you maybe explain a bit what is then actually done with a reconstructed quantum state? Like once you have access to it, what do you do with it?
Yes, so what we do is, so we have the state preparation, VQE, for instance, we take the measurements and then we reconstruct the state. Okay? And so we have an estimation of what the state looks like written in terms of this transformer. Okay? So it's a transformer wave function, quote unquote. And then what we do is we run variational Monte Carlo, where the initial wave function that we computed is the one we reconstructed. So it's, if you want, the initialization of the state corresponds to what we reconstructed from the data. And then what we do is we solve or try to solve this minimization problem with variational Monte Carlo, which is minimization of the energy with respect to the Hamiltonian you're trying to solve, starting from the wave function that you just reconstructed.
Maybe what I'm rather asking is the point of this, like with quantum phase transitions, that you already have like a analytical solution maybe of what the ground state is, and you just want to prove, like proof of principle that this technique works to find that ground state?
No.
Or you have systems where you really don't know the ground state and then want to interpret this afterwards?
Yes.
Physics point of view.
Yeah, exactly. So So perhaps I didn't explain that and I shouldn't have. So what we're interested in is we're given a problem Hamiltonian H that is very large, hopefully in principle, so not in this paper, but in principle you're given a Hamiltonian with many, many coefficients for a complicated system, and you're asked to compute the ground state or approximate its ground state. Okay? And so one of the ways you can do that is through a variational or with a quantum algorithm. And there are state preparation algorithms that allows you to, in principle, do that. Okay? They are, I don't know, VQE, phase estimation, they're different ones. But since those machines are imperfect, when you run those algorithms, the states that they produce are not quite the ground state of that Hamiltonian. Okay, and then so what we do, or what we hope to do, is we take those measurements on the approximate state preparation we did with the quantum computer, and we do a reconstruction of the state that we can then fine tune to better approximate the ground state of H through this optimization process.
And are those ground states interesting from like a theoretical physics point of view, or do you have an actual use for them?
No, yeah, exactly. So it's for practical reasons. It's because finding ground states can lead to a lot of understanding and solution to real problems. Like in quantum chemistry, for instance, reaction rates depend on ground states of the stable configurations. And so it's an interesting problem in condensed matter, is because we want to understand phases of matter and what they look like and their behavior. And at low temperature, the state of a quantum system in nature, at very, very low temperature, it's the ground state. And so if you're interested in understanding a lot of phenomena in condensed matter physics, in many cases, it boils down to solving this problem. And that's why people are interested in tackling this from many different perspectives.
So if we just skip the middle step and took the imperfect preparation and did the variational Monte Carlo, what are the things we would miss then?
So can you repeat the question again?
If you just skip the middle part,
this reconstruction,
the imperfect prepared state from the quantum simulation and run the variational Monte Carlo to minimize.
Yeah, so that's a problem with that. So in that, for variation Monte Carlo, you need a wave function. And so if you don't have a wave function, you cannot just use this data. I mean, you could use this data as a variational wave function, but that would give you a terrible approximation of the energy, because it would assume that configurations you didn't see in the experiment would be zero. And so that would give you, and then on top of that, the so you will have a high variance energy and a poor value. That's my guess. So I've never done that before, though. But my guess is, based on the data, if you just take, it's basically a histogram, and then you define a wave function, you can define a wave function. But my guess is the energy that you would get in the end is a very poor prediction of the true ground state that you're trying to look at.
So from the quantum device, we only get the data finally after the, means I was thinking whether we can take that state that we get, the psi theta there, which we're trying to reconstruct in step two.
Yeah.
So we don't have access to psi theta from the quantum simulation.
No, so when you have a quantum experiment, this quantum state is something we imagine and that we know it is produced in nature, but we never have access to its amplitudes. You only have access through measurements, right? Okay, so that's it. The last is more on the same problem. It's just showing for a particular problem called the Schringer model that the whole procedure works. And so again, this is the noisy data, and then the corrected or error mitigated data in here. This is for the energy, this is for the entanglement entropy, and this is for the difference in energy between the exact one and the between the exact energy and the approximations that we found as a function of system size. So for molecules, it's hard to do finite size scaling because molecules have very well defined shapes and so on, and you cannot just start adding more and more electrons and so on. For this lattice Schringer model, you can add one more spin at a time, and so you can see the behavior of your error correction or your error mitigation as you grow the size of the system. And what we saw is that, as we make the system bigger and bigger, the accuracy suffers a little bit, but you still get orders of magnitude improvement of your estimation. So we thought that was successful. So I had one more topic, but I don't have time. It's a real-time dynamics of open quantum systems. But let me just go and wrap up. So we've seen neural autoregressive models for many body physics. That's a bunch of papers we've produced. In state reconstruction, simulation of quantum circuits, I didn't discuss. Recurrent neural networks, you've seen. Variational neural annealing, you didn't see, I believe, but it's a way to produce very accurate solutions to spin glass problems that beat simulated annealing and simulated quantum annealing. So that was very surprising too. You saw neural error mitigation today, just now. Simulation of open quantum system dynamics, which I wanted to discuss, but I didn't have time, and more. I want to highlight this one too, data-enhanced variational Monte Carlo for Rydberg atoms, just produced at Perimeter. Skyler, one of the authors, it's just here. There's U1 symmetric recurrent neural networks for quantum state reconstructions and more. I mean, there's a lot of work that has been produced, but also I think there's a lot of opportunities here to do more. So let me conclude. So I think now is a privileged time for quantum research, like lots of opportunities arising from artificial intelligence, quantum computing, which are some of the most promising computational paradigms of the century, I would say. This body of recent work showcases these opportunities. It's all like in machine learning techniques and their research culture, which is very different from our physics research culture. And I believe this can spark some interesting research directions and I don't know, maybe taking the field in a different direction and so on. I guess the questions I have for you is what's a plausible goal for the near term? Can machine learning lead to scientific breakthroughs in quantum physics? So we're still at an uncertain point regarding that question, but I don't know. So I think we can develop models and see. I think we're here. So sort of here. So we have this initial exploration where we do toy models and toy examples, and everything works and it looks promising. Then you do computational projects and you go bigger, and there are a series of computational breakthroughs, I would say, that demonstrate high potential for these techniques. Okay, I don't think we're getting close to solving real problems. Okay, maybe not breakthroughs, but solving problems. But this is where we should go, right? And I don't know if there's a clear path to a big scientific breakthrough, but we should, at least since there's potential, we should try, right? Like, and I think it's exciting. And with that, I'll just stop. Thank you.